For the audio record, today's October 31st, 2024. This argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording. The audio record of today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. As a reminder, there are no other recordings without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. With that, I will call our third case for the day, case number A24-0632. In re petition of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Good morning, counsel. As I'm sure you are aware, you will each be given 15 minutes for your argument, and appellants, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Are you dividing your time? Okay. You're taking 11 in the rebuttal, and then you'll have four.
That's correct.
Okay, perfect. Just making sure I'm doing my math correctly. Please, for all of you, to feel free to take the time to adjust the podium to the appropriate height for your comfort. There's a button in the middle of the podium. It can take a little bit to find it. And if you would please identify yourself and your client for the audio record, that would be much appreciated. And with that, first counsel, for appellant, you have 11 minutes.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Jack Pierce, and I represent Appellant Creative Real Estate, Inc. The district court in this matter erred in granting summary judgment in two respects. However, the only respect that is necessary for this court's decision is on whether or not the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency waived any rights it otherwise may have had to challenge Creative Real Estate's redemption from the foreclosure sale. And I would respectfully suggest to the court that all it needs to look at is Your Honor's opinion in L&T. L&T pretty much summarizes the entirety of my client's argument. The L&T opinion is almost directly on point. The L&T succinctly deals with most, if not all, of the arguments that are being raised by the MHFA in its appeal brief. The similarities. Check was received. Check was cashed. The check for the MHFA, they still have it. From a timing perspective, on March 9th, MHFA receives a check from the Anoka County Sheriff's Department. It deposits that check on April 28th, 6 weeks later. The legal similarities are the driving force behind Creative Real Estate's challenge to the district court's grant of summary judgment. It also should be noted that on this legal issue, the standard of review is de novo. In L&T, it discussed Clark, and even if the funds had been returned, it does not rescind the waiver. In Clark, the funds were returned 10 days after receipt. Or two, Supreme Court agreed that judgment upon which the right to redeem was granted was extinguished. It had been paid, but still, accepting the funds challenged the right to redemption. In Grant, the challenger in Grant may have had the opportunity to challenge the basis upon which the junior creditor was attempting to redeem, but again, it waived that right by accepting the funds. In quoting from Your Honor and L&T, from this line of cases, we discern that a party waives the right to challenge a redemption when they accept the redemption money and appropriate it for themselves. That is exactly the situation here. Now, understandably, MHFA did not have the opportunity to address the L&T opinion in its response brief directly, but it does not challenge that it accepted the funds. It did not challenge that it still has the funds. It cannot because it did.
I think it actually does challenge that it accepted the funds, doesn't it? I mean, don't they say we didn't solicit? I think they're drawing a distinction between solicitation of the funds, actively going out and seeking the funds, and simply receipt of the check.
2 points to that, Your Honor. First, in L&T, the court said that solicitation of the funds was the only distinction when it was discussing Hansen v. Woolston, was the only distinction between Clark, and that distinction is gone. But the issue of solicitation, which really wasn't answered by MHFA in its brief, is what does that mean? What is solicitation? What constitutes solicitation? Does it require you to actually go to the sheriff's department? It does not, because sheriff.
Well, I think that, right, I think the trouble with all of this is that the guidance that we have from the Supreme Court is all from the 1910s, 1920s, where I don't think that this process existed that exists now, where it's kind of automatic, right? You send the money to the sheriff and the sheriff just automatically cuts a check and sends it, which was not precisely what happened, right? I mean, I'm trying to remember which one it is. One of them, they're like receiving gold bars.
That was on the judgment case.
Right, yes. Right. So I do think that part of the tension that is occurring now in the redemption area has to do with the fact that the guidance we have from the Supreme Court comes from a time where you physically were getting cash or gold bars, or you were getting physical money. And now by operation of the sheriff's statute, checks just kind of get sent. And I think the question is, what happens when you get sent that check? I think that in Hansen, which is just also somewhat procedurally different from the Supreme Court cases, they were really wrestling with, what do you do when you receive that that check, but you don't do anything with it? And I guess I'm wondering if it's contested whether this check was actually deposited, or whether the facts are really clear that this is the L&T case where the check was. It's not just that you receive it. It's that you receive it and then decide to cash it and make those assets liquid so that you could use those assets. Is, I think, the distinction that's been made in the Hansen and L&T line of cases. And I'd just like to know from the record whether it's clear that this was the, they've actually deposited and appropriated that money to themselves and then tried to remove that money, or this is a, they had a check and then they gave that check to their counsel.
Two answers to your question. I'll start with the second first. Index number 43 at page 2, MHFA's counsel deposited the check on April 28, 2002, ostensibly into its trust account. The following day, index number 55 at page 43, MHFA notified E&T that it objected to CRE's redemption. The second answer to the question, I think, addresses the solicitation question as well. What is it to accept? To accept is to receive, is it not? And with the understanding of these long line of cases that by accepting the redemption funds, you may have waived your right. The best practice, and in fact, the practice used by many practitioners, is when you accept the funds, you return them to the sheriff because you're contesting the redemption. Here, MHFA did not do that. It receives the check on March 9. According to it, on March 24, it learned of an issue with CRE's redemption. What did it do? Nothing. It didn't do anything until a month later. On the 25th of April, did it send it back to the sheriff? No. It forwarded the check from the Anoka County Sheriff to its counsel.
So has this check been deposited in counsel's account?
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
So this is different from L&T. Factually, this is different. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the facts of this case. Because in L&T, it was the money was deposited in their own personal bank account. Here we have a case where they didn't initially cash the check. And then eventually they cashed that check, but they put it into an account with their attorney. Okay. So does that distinction have a difference?
No.
And why not?
Because I believe... It was an or two. There, the plaintiff held the check and was ready to give it back at trial. It had physical possession of the check. I don't remember specifically if in or two the check was actually deposited, but it had the check. It had dominion over the check. So whether or not that's actually used for a third party purpose to purchase whatever, or have the check. In Clark, the check was returned. In Hansen, they held on to the check, and I think
these aren't checks, though, right? I mean, that's what I'm trying to say is, like, in at least one of these, we were talking about gold bars. I'm trying to remember. I think another one was for sure cash. Like, they went to the bank and took the cash out of the vault. Is my like recollection of the cases. And so I think that there has been this distinction made with regard to these sheriff checks that there has to be some way when the sheriff sends you the check of not waiving it because that check arrives in your mailbox.
You mail it back to the sheriff, which is what practitioners do today. And here's the question that hasn't been answered by MHFA.
And how much time, right? I think that this is like, then how much time do you have to mail that check back? What's the, right? I mean, like, then we're getting into what I do think is kind of a gray area with the existing law as it exists with regard to redemption, which is how does the fact that this check is just appears in your mailbox, like, then we've got, seems like timing issues. It seems like we've got a lot of intricacies. And how do, does the fact that some of these old cases don't actually deal with a check, they're dealing with physical money, like how do we reconcile
that? Sure. I think there's two issues that address the court's question. In Clark, if we're looking for how much time you have, in Clark, the funds were returned 10 days after receipt, and that was not sufficient. So at the very minimum, you should return those funds at least 10 days prior. Secondly, and here's the question that has not been answered by MHFA nor the district court. If you hold on to the check for a year, 2 years, then do you get to challenge? When does it end? When is the end date? One of the fundamental tenets of Minnesota real estate law is predictability in real estate transactions. Here, I think it was April 9, Mr. Nashram can correct me if I'm wrong, April 9, the deed from Creative Real Estate to ENT was registered on the memorial, on the certificate of title. That's even before the check is sent off by MHFA to its counsel. If the MHFA, or anybody for that matter, I don't mean to cast aspersions on MHFA, but if anybody for that matter can hold on to the check for an indeterminate amount of time and then challenge the ability for somebody's right to redeem, that certainly doesn't result in predictability in real estate transactions, and it certainly constitutes a waiver. Again, if the court is looking to a timeline or to a calendar event in previous case law, it need only look to Clark.
Does it make a difference whether this is Torrance property?
I see my time is expiring. Can I? No. Okay. The only difference between Torrance and Abstract in this matter would be the process that occurs after the foreclosure sale. In Torrance property, you have to do what's called a proceeding subsequent to initial registration. In Abstract, you don't. But the concept is the same.
Counsel, when you come back, I am hoping we can reach the point of discussing the mechanics lien and whether or not CRE was an owner, equitable owner. Okay.
I look forward to it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Eric Nashstrom, and I represent the respondent ENT Property LLC, which acquired the property in interest from Mr. Pierce's clients. We join Mr. Pierce's arguments in all respects with request to the issue of waiver and also the issue of the ownership of the property at the time the mechanics lien was filed. And with that in mind, I don't have too much to add. I would like to address a few points. First of all, with respect to the depositing of the money, factually it's different, yes, because it went into their counsel's account. But legally, under basic agency principle law, I would argue that is no different. They, being their agent, the person they control as the client, had control over where those account, what was done with that money. So
why isn't submitting it to your attorney the equivalent of, you know, putting it in escrow?
Because an escrow agreement involves the other party to that, that would have an interest in that money, that could, and the escrow agent would be obligated to not disperse until both sides agreed. They had full control of that money. Had they released it, there's not a thing that ENT or Creative could have done legally. It was in their possession and control. And I do believe that's different from an escrow agreement where both sides have to agree to put the money in escrow and the escrow agent won't release it until it has the consent of both sides.
To redeem from a mortgage foreclosure, do you have to have a legitimate right of redemption? I mean, can any, if a waiver is applicable, can any Joe Blow come in and pay the money, and if they take it, then they get the property?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And in this case, Creative filed a mechanics lien. They recorded against the property 7 days or in excess of 7 days prior to the expiration of the redemption period. They recorded their notice of intent to redeem. They paid the redemption funds. So while
also satisfied the mechanics lien.
Your Honor, they signed a satisfaction. However, they never delivered it. That was never recorded. There's no information in the record showing that was the intent of either executive title, which explains in the record that that was a mistake, nor is there any statement from Creative itself. They say that this was just done as a curative measure in the event we needed to clear title. And it would defy really the entire process. Why would they satisfy their lien while simultaneously redeeming through that lien? It logically doesn't follow, and the facts don't allow for that inference that they satisfied their lien. And again, it was never recorded at all. So we argue that that has no effect on the ownership interest. And I see my time is running out, and I perhaps should have allotted myself more. I would also add to this entire process that E&T is a third party here that purchased this property at closing for $225,000. That purchase and that acquisition and their deed was recorded on April 28th of 2022. And Mr. Pierce was asking me to correct or wondering whether I could have the time frame when our deed was recorded, and I just said it wrong. Our deed was recorded on April 12th of 2022. It was on April 28th that the redemption funds are deposited into the account of MHFA. And that's significant because it also shows that all the facts and all the information available to the MHFA at the time that it causes its counsel to, or causes its money to be deposited in its attorney's account, was known to it. It knew who Creative was, it knew who our client was, and it knew that our client had paid $225,000 for this property, which is really what's driving its interest here, because that was far in excess of the redemption amount, which they had been paid in full. But now they're looking to get more, and they do that by having my client's interest in the property eliminated. So I see that I am out of time. If there's any other questions, I could field them. Otherwise, I'll defer to Mr. Dolby and then Mr. Pierce.
Excellent. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you will have the full 15 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Dobie on behalf of Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I think your honors asked many of the prescient questions in this case, and I'd like to address some of those. First, the evidence that's in the record is that the check was, after it was received at the counsel's office from the sheriff, it was sent to U.S. Bank, the mortgage servicer, and it was sent to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, the sheriff's certificate holder, and then it was returned and deposited in attorney trust account after Minnesota Housing Finance Agency was notified that dissatisfaction existed. And I do think that the trust account is not the same as L&T Tree, and I have a couple of good reasons why. First is, in this case, there involved two parties that may claim these funds. And it might not have been clear, but it's not in the record, who was entitled to the funds if this is an invalid redemption. And returning them to the sheriff, I mean, if Creative was an underhanded foreclosure speculator, I'm not saying that they are, but if they were, what's to say that the sheriff might not let them have it back? They come in and say, oh yeah, we agree our redemption was invalid. we'll take the money back. Is the sheriff going to give it back to Creative? We don't know, but it's possible. And if
they should, if they come and say that their redemption was invalid, then they should get the money back, because then your client would have the property.
That's a great point, Your Honor. And in this case,
Right. I mean, because the whole purpose of this, right, is that everybody gets made whole. And so, you know, your client is the senior creditor.
Yep.
Their client is the junior creditor. They send the money, which also fulfills the obligation to make your client whole. And if what your client wants is the property, as opposed to being made whole financially with the money, then I think that the purpose of this case law has been, you can't sit on your hands. You have to do your due diligence to decide whether or not you're going to accept that check if what it is that you want is the property and not to be made financially whole, which I don't think that you would disagree that from a financial perspective, your client has been made whole.
Yes, that's true. The law does provide that the purchaser at a sheriff's sale is entitled to acquire title to the property unless it's redeemed by a lawful redemptioner. And that's cited a lot in the cases that we cited. Anyway, the point I wanted to make is that here, E&T funded the redemption. It was their money. So if Creative goes back to the sheriff and says, we want our money back, now we don't, our redemption was invalid. Now E&T doesn't have that money, and E&T doesn't have the property because Creative has just admitted that their redemption was void. Sure, E&T might be able to go after Creative, but that just causes a huge mess that is going to certainly require a ton of litigation. And so I think the better practice, it was to deposit the funds with the court. But
that's not what happened here.
In the transcript of the argument, at page 5, 8 through 15, the counsel for Minnesota Housing, me, argued that the shortly after filing the petition, Minnesota Housing was calling the court, calling E&T to deposit the funds with the court. And that was the intention the entire time, but eventually E&T and Minnesota Housing agreed by stipulation at document number 10 that the funds could remain deposited in the attorney trust account. We sort of said it's going to be easier to get them released if it's from our attorney trust.
But the money had already been deposited.
That's true, Your Honor.
So why doesn't that put us into the Clark or line of cases where just because the money could get released again doesn't mean that you have it waived?
So this is the intent and timing and waiver standard. I mean, waiver is an affirmative defense. The burden is on the person asserting the affirmative defense. And in those cases, with all due respect, I think that part 6 of OR 2, which is the often quoted part of OR 2 that says that it's the broad waiver quote that cited in L&T, quoted in L&T, and quoted other places. That quote, I believe, is not supported by the cases that OR 2 itself cites. And here's why we know that. Because Todd versus Johnson 1, the first Todd case, the purchaser at the sheriff's sale challenged the junior creditor's judgments to redeem. And the trial court decided in favor of the judgment creditors. The Supreme Court reversed and said, no, you need to prove up your liens first. You must be a lawful redemptioner. You must prove up your liens first.
But that's not what Grant says, and Grant was decided after OR.
So, and I want to get to that in just a second, Your Honor. The dissent in Todd 1 is Justice Mitchell, and he's advocating, but didn't get the majority on it, for exactly the rule that you're stating and was stated in L&T Tree. And Grant versus Bibb, first the court determines that there was no judgment, that the person challenging the credit, the person challenging the judgment waited 14 months to challenge the judgment. 7 months after the appeal was decided, determining that that judgment was void. And the court, so the court looked at the judgment and said, this was public knowledge. You were on inquiry notice that there was an appeal pending. So in other words, if you're on inquiry notice and you know that this appeal is pending, then the court can infer that you've waived your right to challenge it. And I think the 14 months also played a factor for that court. And then finally, the statement in that decision regarding the waiver specifically stated that it was a waiver of the rights to challenge the notice of intention to redeem and the failure to provide the affidavit of additional amount due. So
is this case actually distinguishable from all of the cases that we've been talking about so far in that it's alleged, right, and the court, district court found that in fact there was this mechanics lien that had been satisfied the day before, forget what the dates were, and perhaps intentionally established for the purpose of, you know, allowing CRE to engage in the redemption process. And so I guess I'm wondering if any of those cases are applicable.
I do think the law from those cases does apply, but I do think that this case is distinguishable. In Orr 2, it's interesting, the share certificate purchaser then was also the first in line to redeem. But these folks were all trying to be the last in line to redeem so that they could be the owner, ultimate owner of the property. And the court and the court said that the fifth redemption was invalid. That was in Orr 1, the judgment, or it was a mortgage, and they failed to pay the mortgage registry tax, so it was invalid. But then the court said in the part 6 that I mentioned earlier that the only person who could have challenged the redemption was that purchaser who then became the first in line judgment creditor who redeemed. So there is some similarity, like there's a lot of gamesmanship in this area about who's going to be the last in line to redeem, who can put a mortgage on to clog the equity and prevent others from redeeming. You have ex-spouses conveying to one speculator and another spouse conveying to another speculator. And I do think it's important to remember that the purpose of the redemption statute is, one, for the owner is to save their house, potentially save their equity. And then two, for junior creditors, it's to pay off junior creditors that are legitimate, that had a claim. I think it's usually stated that it's the property should be used as far as it may go to pay other creditors, right? I mean, that's not what we had here. We had an entity which by all accounts appears to have, in my opinion, abused its corporate formalities to place this mechanics lien on the property. And that
we have two issues here, right? The first one is whether or not there was a waiver,
yeah,
of the right to challenge. The second is whether or not the district court erred when it granted summary judgment, when it determined that in fact CRE didn't have a valid interest, either because the mechanics lien had been satisfied or because it had an equitable ownership in the property and therefore should have redeemed in the initial 6 month period. If we were to agree with the district court on that second issue, would we even need to reach the first issue? Because isn't whether waiver occurred irrelevant at that point?
Your Honor, I think the cases do say that even a person without a legitimate judgment lien, this goes to your question, Judge Smith, is without a valid interest, you can still waive. But the waiver
No, that there can be a waiver even if the person who gets the property didn't have a valid interest, if you have appropriated the money to yourself during the redemption process, is what Grant says.
Yes, and I think that the facts in that case were dependent on knowledge and timing too. And waiver, and the Carlson versus Duran is the case that we have both cited, I think, for the more modern standard of waiver. And I think that those cases all say that you can infer waiver from the circumstances. It is a fact issue, but you can infer and you could determine whether there is a waiver from the circumstances. I'm not denying that.
But that issue was decided. I mean, in L&T, that issue was raised and this court decided that we're bound by the precedent in Grant and Orr and Clark. So even applying more general principles of waiver, applying a broader sense of waiver, what you're calling more modern sense of waiver, we as the Court of Appeals are not allowed to overturn 100-year-old precedent from the Minnesota Supreme Court as to what constitutes waiver in the context of redemption.
Right. And I do think that those cases that you cited are distinguishable. My first point was that Todd 1 is exactly the opposite. The judgment creditors still, it was reversed. They still had to prove up their judgment liens. In Todd 2, they said 8 years is too late. Actually, in Todd 2, first they said the judgments were valid. So that should have been the end of the decision. They were entitled to redeem. The judgments were valid. But then they also said, you accepted and appropriated the money for 8 years, and now you're coming back to us trying to challenge the redemption?
I mean, but Todd's an earlier case than Grant and Orr.
So, but Todd is cited, both Todd 1 and Todd 2 are cited in Orr for the rule that Your Honor is saying is the more recent rule. But it's not cited as a distinguish or overruling. It's cited as support for the rule in Orr. So the only way to make sense of that is that that part 6 of Orr 2 must be dicta. But
it's not dicta in Grant.
In Grant, Your Honor, let me just, in Grant, the person attacking the judgment had knowledge. So that's part of the waiver analysis, is intent, knowledge and intent. Inquiry notice was at least one of the determining factors.
You're citing to the facts section, but the actual analysis is, we would not want to hold that Bruner had, in fact, a right to redeem. We think plaintiff might have refused to recognize the redemption. Had it done so, the attempted redemption would undoubtedly have failed upon the reversal of the Bruner judgment and effectively would have been an execution of the sale. But plaintiffs did not so refuse. On the contrary, they received the redemption money and accepted and appropriated it to themselves. By doing so, they conceded Bruner's right to redeem and waived any defect in his title to do so. And I don't know how that is not the central holding. I get your point about notice and opportunity, but all of that's in the fact part of the decision. When it comes down to what were the relevant facts with regard to the waiver, it was that they received the redemption money and they appropriated it to themselves.
So in that fact section, that's the setup for the court deciding the rule of law in that case. And if you're saying that they made a broader rule of law than was necessary to decide that case, then that, yes, is indicative of what they might say in other cases, but I don't think it's the holding of that case. And I see my time is up.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Pierce, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm going to spend just a brief moment on my time on the waiver issue because I know Your Honor wants me to talk about the mechanics lien. There's a lot of argument that was made here that's not based on the facts in the record and also not based on the law. With respect to intent, as Your Honor noted, footnote 6 of L&T says you accept the redemption funds. Counsel made a lot of arguments about why, perhaps, although not in the record, MHFA didn't want to give the money back to the sheriff because there may be a fight with other parties about it. Okay. That's a fight for ENT and creative. It's not a fight for the MHFA. In fact, there should be creatives in ENT's fight had that happened. MHFA has no dog in that fight. What they have to do is they have to send the money back. There was a little bit of discussion concerning notice of inquiry.
Do you disagree? I mean, counsel, do you disagree? Had they gotten the check and then tried to submit the money to the court, that might have had the same effect of submitting it to a sheriff's sale, or if they had somehow put the check in an escrow account, that there might be other actions that would also not be appropriating the money to yourself that are not sending the check back?
Yeah, I'm not on the escrow. I agree with Mr. Nashman on the escrow. But there's a procedural vehicle to deposit money into court. I believe it's Rule 24. MHFA could have used Rule 24 to deposit it into court. But that's a distinction without a difference. They don't have to. They got to send it back to the sheriff. They've got to return the funds. And even if they had deposited the money with the court, it doesn't answer the question as to when. Today, could they deposit the money with the court and cure any defects with respect to waiver? My answer to that question is no. And MHFA has not provided any argument to this court, either in writing or argument here today. When does that time period end?
Well, I think they do have support with the Hansen case from this court, but it could be longer than 10 days where one might not appropriate the money to oneself and still be able to have a valid redemption claim. How would you respond to that application of Hansen?
Well, one, I think Hansen, respectfully, was improperly decided based on Clark and Grant. The Hansen decision doesn't even cite to Grant. And as Your Honor noted in LNT, there was the distinction that was referenced in Hansen came from Clark and does not deal with Grant. So I don't think that the Hansen decision, I think, respectfully, I think that's somewhat of an outlier based on the equities involved in that case.
But I just understood your argument to be that the 10 days comes from Clark, and I think Hansen did address Clark.
Well, but it did on the issue of solicitation. I mean, in what Hansen said is that in Clark, they actively solicited the funds. And we've spent a little bit of time talking about solicitation, and that has changed. But it doesn't deal with Grant, doesn't deal with Orr, doesn't deal with Leland. And I think it's Clark and Leland both say that you're on notice. If we want to talk about notice, and I apologize for speaking.
No, I think you've answered my question, and I want to make sure that I give you some time to respond to Judge Wheelock's questions about the entitlement to redeem.
Sure. The district court erred in granting summary judgment on fact issues. It was a factual issue as to whether or not there was intent or delivery with respect to the satisfaction. And as argued in our brief, it makes no logical sense as to why a party would satisfy a mechanics lien, intending to satisfy it, and then seek to redeem. As is explained in the record, Executive Title, a party not to this action, but who was handling the closing of the transaction between Creative and ENT, wanted to have a satisfaction just in case there was a title issue down the road. They made the mistake. And in fact, I think the entirety of this case stems down to what Executive Title did or did not do. But there was no intent, there was no delivery. And even if MHFA were to argue there was, that's a fact question. If it is a fact question, it cannot be resolved on summary judgment, which is what the district court did.
That's the mechanics lien, right? But then there's also the equitable interest.
Okay, let me speak to that. And my time is gonna be expiring, so if I can have a little bit of time afterwards.
You can feel free to respond to Judge Wheelock's question.
Unfortunately, counsel below didn't, I think, accurately flush out this argument based on the record. There's three things I want to point out to Your Honor. One, the transaction agreement is with Renovation Group. Two, the deeds were to Renovation Group. So the transfer of interest in the property was to Renovation Group, not Creative. The equitable interest stems from the district court thinking that there was a request for admission that said Creative had an ownership interest in the property. It's wrong. And if I may, the reason it's wrong is due to, I think, believe some inartful drafting. This is in index number 53, at page 118. Here's what the two requests for admissions that the district court relied on. In 2021, this is the request. Creative Real Estate, Inc. entered into a written agreement to acquire an interest in the property, period. With whom? Doesn't indicate with whom. Doesn't say with whom it acquired an interest from. Doesn't reference that. The next request for admission. In 2021 or 2022, Creative Real Estate entered into a written agreement with one or more of the heirs, which required them to vacate the property in exchange for payment. The answer, and this is not the revised answers, this is the original answers. Admit only that the reference parties were paid for their heirship interest in the real property. Deny any further allegation or implication. There is certainly a fact issue as to whether or not Creative Real Estate had an equitable ownership interest in the property.
Is there anything in the record that illuminates the relationship between CRE and Renovation Group?
They have common officers. I think their relationship is irrelevant for this analysis. They're separate legal entities. They're separate corporations. The mere fact that their officers are the same, and I know counsel, I don't think that Pearson, the corporate veil, was really argued below, but if you look at Victoria Elevator, that imposes liability on a shareholder. It doesn't impose liability on another company. And I see my time has expired, and unless, of course, any more questions for me.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your argument today. This case has been submitted, and we will issue a decision in the time prescribed by statute.
Thank you.